This is Chris Evans with a Storage Unpacked podcast, and as usual, I'm here with Martin. How are you, Martin?
Yeah, not too bad.
You allowed out of the house?
No, not yet.
So anybody who isn't aware, you're in quarantine, aren't you, technically?
I'm in quarantine, so I got pinged by the NHS Track and Trace app, which says I'd been in contact with somebody who had tested positive, so I have to stay by myself for 10 days, which is a very unusual experience when you're sharing a house with your family. So it's an interesting dance, but I also can't get out. So socially distanced Valentine's Day was fun.
Wow. Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, that was yesterday, wasn't it? Yeah,
it was. So, yeah, I can't wait till midnight Thursday and I can get back to normal, I hope.
Yes. Well, do you know what? It probably isn't that much different other than maybe going out for a walk, really, is it?
Oh, yeah. I really miss going out for a walk, and there were some really nice, clear, cold days, and I like going out there, take some pictures, and I've missed all that. Yeah. So, yeah, it's all warmed up. It's warm and damp now, which is not so enticing to go out.
But. Yeah. Well, the weather's improving, so hopefully, as of Thursday, you'll be able to get back out again.
Yeah.
So this week we've got a guest, and we've got somebody who's probably quite used to the idea of snow and the bad weather. Sabaya Sundram from Haiku. How are you, Sabaya?
Doing great, Chris and Martin. Great to be with you guys again. And we are doing great. And yes, as you said, in Boston, there's lots of snow. There's actually 2 foot of snow outside my house. And there's more expected today.
So wow.
It's a lot of fun.
We just need to stop moaning sometimes, don't we, Martin? Well, not that we moan. I don't think we moan about the weather particularly, but that's a lot of snow.
Yeah, 2 inches of snow is a lot in the UK, I think. We come to a grinding halt.
Absolutely. You're not kidding. And I think in Texas they had bad snow, didn't they, which is very unusual. So the weather's a bit wacky this year. Yep. Never mind. We're not here to talk about the weather. We're here to talk about your new product release, your new announcement that you made in the last week, Sabaya, which is around the idea of backup as a service, backing up SaaS platforms, and support for Office 365, as some people call it, or Microsoft Office. You announced that within the last week, haven't you?
That's right, Chris. Excited to announce the support for, we currently still call it Office 365, and as you know, Microsoft is in the process of rebranding it to Microsoft 365. So yes, we do support that right now.
So we use it in our business, and I know a lot of people who use it and probably didn't realize that they should be backing up a SaaS solution. But obviously, it's super important to be backing up SaaS because the vendor's not doing it for you, is it?
You're absolutely true. I think Microsoft recommends to customers, even in their contract, it explicitly tells them, please back up the data. It's also, as we all are people who live in breathe backup for a long time, or data protection and storage for a long time, we clearly know it's a good idea to always have a second copy somewhere else outside of the original source. Good backup discipline. Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, it's known as the 3-2-1 Ted Rogers rule, isn't it, Martin, I think?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. No, it's interesting. I mean, this whole thing, I think a lot of people are very surprised when they realise that they should be backing up their Office 365 data, or they think, oh, surely Microsoft are backing it all up for me. But no, it's not the case.
Yeah, Microsoft are backing it up for Microsoft.
Yeah.
In case they have to restore your service so that they can give you continuous service. They're not backing it up so that if you do some sort of fat finger or stupid mistake and delete something you really want back, they're not going to fix that for you. So obviously, super important to be backing up your SaaS platforms. And not only just because obviously you might want the data back, but clearly it might be part of your compliance rules that you have to keep that data for a certain length of time. So you can't afford to not be backing up these sort of solutions. So Sabaya, why don't you just tell us what you did announce so we can understand what the new platform support actually is, and then we can dig into some detail.
Absolutely, Chris. What we announced earlier last week was we are officially supporting Microsoft Office 365 data protection, which is Office 365, which is a software as a service. And we protect the data in that infrastructure for customers, in that service for customers. Even though a lot of people think of Office 365 as one, as all of us know, it's a bunch of services put together, right? They have the email, which most people think, that's what, when they think of O365, they think of email, but there's a lot more to it. There's email, there's OneDrive, there's SharePoint, there's Teams. I mean, you go on and there's so much to Office 365 richness right now. And as you guys actually started saying, Office 365 is the place where all of the companies or corporates' communication comes into play, right? And that's the data which all of us and the companies actually use for communication, for interaction, for exchange, sharing with other organizations, things like that. So that's why it becomes so important. What we observe, Chris, is that, I'm going into a little bit longer thing, but there's a reason why I wanted to share with that, is that a lot of times when people think of O365, they only think of just one of the dimensions. That's originally because a lot of people said for two reasons they went to O365. For SharePoint, they didn't want to manage it in-house. And the second reason is for email. Those are two reasons they decided to go to the public cloud. Now, after there are so many tools available on the online, and Microsoft has brought a lot of them together. So what we see customers do, Chris and Martin, is that they're trying to take advantage of all of the capabilities. For example, Teams. For a long time, Teams has been there and has been evolving so fast. Finally, we start seeing lots of customers adopt Teams en masse. That's one thing. Second thing, earlier people used Dropbox, Box, all the other tools for collaborating data sharing. And now they're saying, if OneDrive is already included as part of my Office 365, why not use it? So that's why we are seeing tremendous adoption. And I think what we announced was support for that. We announced it as the backup and recovery support, but it actually has a lot more capability than that.
Okay. So I just wanted to sort of touch on it a bit more, Martin. I think, I look at the way that things have evolved and think the Office 365 side of things, and obviously there are other solutions as well, so Gmail and other platforms, but it's a pretty good solution to deliver as a SaaS offering, because administering email is not the most exciting job in the world. Giving it to somebody else to do, where you can scale up, scale down, is a really nice thing to do to push those things off. And if you've ever administered SharePoint, you'd know it's like almost literally having your nails pulled out with a pair of pliers. So I think these seem like natural services to move towards SaaS. And I would imagine they'll be very much long-term in that position. But you know, like we said earlier, you cannot afford not to be backing them up and not having some sort of access to that data.
No, it's true. I mean, absolutely. And it's the whole Exchange admin. Exchange admins, it always used to be a nightmare. They'd get that call, can you recover that mailbox? And it was always a bit of a dark art about getting backed up and the right plugin for your right backup program to get it back. So the whole thing of moving it to the cloud has been, or moving it as to a SaaS offering, has really simplified that role. But it doesn't stop the fact you still need to be able to back it up. You still need to be recovering it. And you still need to do a single mailbox recovery for all kinds of reasons. Somebody's done something stupid, or you need a compliance, you need a discovery. It's having all those things in the right place. But you're right, it's invaluable. Office 365 has changed many corporates the way they manage their back office systems.
Yeah. Actually, I had a friend who, when we used to go to the pub at lunchtime in one particular job, he shall remain nameless, but he would frequently come back from the pub after having a few beers, hit Control A and delete in his mailbox, because he'd just think, let's just get rid of all that. Then the next morning, when he actually sat there and thought about it again, he'd suddenly realize, oh, I actually probably needed quite a lot of those emails when people were asking him questions, and he would inevitably ring up and have to get his mailbox recovered. So, you know, there are many, many examples of why we need to keep hold of this data so we can get it back. But let's dig into a bit more detail about what Haiku are offering, Sabaya. So this is a service. So where is it running?
Great question. So it's a fully managed service. For the customer perspective, they just turn it on and use it. It's a fully managed service. Runs actually in the public cloud too, as you could imagine. We run it in the public cloud. One of the things we do, just to be very candid here, is that we run it on AWS, which is a different cloud than Azure, because it gives a safety for customers because your backup is in a different infrastructure. The classic good best practices here. That's how it's actually run today.
Okay, now that's interesting, because I know the services that are run in Azure run their backup services in Azure. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but just, I guess there is no reason why you shouldn't be able to run these anywhere. The only issue there, of course, is potentially network traffic and other things that you've got to bear in mind that you've got to support and you've got to cover the cost for, because ultimately the customer has got a different delivery model here, hasn't they? They're not paying for the actual infrastructure, they're paying for a service, so the charging model's different.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I think one of the things which, as people have gone to the public cloud, as you guys know, it's almost like, it's the value for the money. They are saying, if I spend something, I got to say, I got a certain amount of value, right? And in this case, it's become very clear to them that they've decided to go to the public cloud. They want to leverage the capability which is there. They pay Microsoft on a per mailbox basis or per user basis. And they want a lot of the other solutions also to be on the same metric. And I think that's one of the reasons we charge them customer on a per user you have protected on O365, which includes everything in the O365. Again, even though we think in terms of user as a mailbox, but in reality, as you know, user has OneDrive, Teams, all the other infrastructure too.
Okay. So if we compare it to like a traditional backup environment, one of the things I've not really delved into with the SaaS offerings is exactly how things like alerting and monitoring go on. So for example, when I do backup in my own infrastructure in an environment, I might have to report on some sort of SLA that says we missed a backup, but we got it the next day. You know, we caught it up or we restarted it. Or I go through at the end of the morning and we look and see, did we back everything up and how did we do in terms of making sure everything was secured? How does it work with a cloud offering? I mean, are you telling the customer and is the customer given a dashboard so they can see what backups have gone on and what's occurred? Because obviously in your on-premises solutions, you can do that. In your cloud solutions, you can do that. How does it work for the SaaS solutions?
Great point. I mean, one of the things here is that you're backing up a SaaS offering, right? Which is actually Microsoft O365 in this case. And Microsoft actually controls how much you use the service. Especially with backup, they want to make sure that we don't overload the system with continuously keep asking, hey, do you have anything new, right? Because it kills the system. So there are ways which Microsoft, if you start overusing it, they will start throttling it. So that's something there. So the way we end up doing is that for example, email, we have multiple mechanisms for customers. By default, we take all the journals. So every email, anything which hits their server is captured. You could decide to send it and then delete it. It still hits the server, so we track it. That's choice A. The choice B for the customer is instead of doing that, they can say every 2 hours, I'll actually back it up, meaning it's almost like a snapshot equivalent of that, right? Every 2 hours. That's something we do. That's for email. But for things like OneDrive, what we decided was that the best thing is to back up once a day for OneDrive, because that's, again, based on the data, change rate, and how much already Microsoft captures certain changes in the middle, right? So that's what we have done for OneDrive. For SharePoint, we back it up 3 times a day. Again, these are optimizations. We have done it as we have actually played with the Microsoft system inside to see what is the best optimal recovery for the customer.
Okay. I'm really interested in that, Martin, I think, because if you think back to, let's have the obligatory mainframe reference. If you think back to the old mainframe days when we'd have some sort of network operations center or operations center where somebody would be monitoring everything that goes through, whether that be the batch jobs or, you know, all of that sort of side of things. Even as we moved on, we still had people who were monitoring and reporting on, you know, success and failure of things like backups. We still need that. I can't see how in a SaaS offering you can do that without still having that ability to monitor and track what's going on.
You still need to know what your backup success rate is. I mean, that's very important. It makes me smile when you talk to a backup team or a backup company and say, okay, we'll guarantee that you're going to get 99% of your backups or 99.9% of your backups. And you say, well, that's very useful. But that means I'm missing 1 in 100 files or 1 in 1,000 files. That may be a file which I actually really wanted. It could be the file which in an email discovery was absolutely key. It saves us millions of dollars of fines. A backup of less than 100% is actually not potentially not very useful. And you want to know it's 100%. You want to see those reds. You want to see it all green. But we all know if you've worked in a backup team, you get used to seeing quite a lot of red and you need that remediation click. The click say, actually, that's failed. Can I rerun it? Hopefully tools like the Haiku tool allows you to do that and say, actually, you know what, I need to take that now. You might need an ad hoc as well. You may want to do something. Even for a OneDrive, you might have said, in the unfortunate case of dismissal, you may want to just be able to click and say, give me that backup now before that person walks out the door or deletes all their files.
So how does that all get handled? Because there's two sides to this, Savaya. I guess there's the fact that a user might want to be able to restore their own data, and obviously they would hope and expect that that backup is done for them on their behalf, irrespective of anything else. But potentially they might want to do their own restore if they've deleted something themselves, so, you know, self-restore. But as Martin says, there's a degree of administration that still needs to happen where an administrator needs to be able to come in and override all of that and just do something ad hoc or whatever, or even restore something ad hoc.
a great point you got, both of you, actually, you and Martin actually mentioned, Chris. I'll give you guys a couple of insights. First is, Martin, I think you talked about the need to monitor even in an infrastructure constantly to make sure all your data is protected, right? The good thing is that, as I said, we journal and we back up the data. But things do go wrong for some reason. Maybe the network access to a particular system is down for some reason for a period of time. There are things outside of control. I mean, things do go wrong. I mean, we just have to get to the point of nature happens. So the thing is that we automatically, as part of the system, it's built in to retry the number of times and things like that is built in, right? And we try to maintain the SLA, which the customer signed up for. If for some reason that we are not able to do that, some of the things which we already have, it's via a SaaS offering or backup as a service offering here. So what we do is that we have automatic alerts. The customer can say, subscribe to a particular email address or like an information. And if for some reason we had to miss something, a backup thing like that, we will automatically let the customer know about it. So that is something built into the system. As I said, it doesn't happen that often, but there are times, as you guys know, one time, one of the large cloud infrastructure, there has been every year, you hear at least a couple of times, where an entire region went down, a site went down, things like that, attacks happened. So when things like that happen for some reason, we will let the customer know. But apart from that, we constantly monitor. Obviously, we are doing 24/7 monitoring for the customer and make sure all the data is protected to the SLA they actually have. So that's something we absolutely do for the customer. And the second thing, I think one of the points, Chris, you were alluding to, which is the point of saying self-service. You talked about the point about saying, hey, can a user, when they deleted something, can they get the data back? That's a great point you mentioned. Because the way we think of is that in organizations, they do, in some of the organizations, we see this bifurcation. One set of organization wants to empower their end users. I'll let you do it. Whenever you mess up something, go do, delete, recover it yourself. That's choice A. The second set of people who we see are, they said, I cannot depend on my end users. I will actually ask them to call the customer support and our support person will actually recover the data. So there are two different things we hear from customers. And the good thing is that we can support both of them because we are tied to Active Directory. And the good thing is that we also track all the usage and who does recovery and what's actually happening. Because anytime you're in compliance, you need to be able to demonstrate who did what. So,
yeah, I was going to ask you about the audit trail because that's a key piece. Sometimes people do things you shouldn't do, and sometimes they say they've done things and they haven't done it. You really do need to be able to see that audit trail, so that's important to know. I'm interested to dig a bit deeper into what it really means to try and deliver a SaaS solution. I'll give an example, Ed, and the reason I think that you sort of led me on there quite nicely to this as a discussion, and that's this whole idea of some users like to do one thing, some like to do another, and how you get the data out of the system and so on. You're sort of fairly tied to the fact that there are certain APIs that you have access to, and you are, I guess, in some respects limited to the access that Microsoft and other vendors would give you in order to deliver your service. So what sort of restrictions are you working within? And, you know, what's the relationship like with somebody like Microsoft to make sure they're giving you what you really need?
So with regards to, I think the good thing is that the vendors actually, because they've been in service for a while now and they've built the cloud model, everything is available as an API and it's publicly available and it's well documented and very useful. So as a partner from Microsoft being able to deliver, it's excellent. The area where we have to actually play with the systems and its limitations is what Microsoft tries to do, is how often you want to back up and how do you back up, right? That's what they try to throttle, because they say don't overuse the resources, because at some point if you start overusing, they throttle you down. So you can ask for a request, it'll take you a couple of seconds to get the response back because you're starting to use too much and they'll control you. That's how they control you. So there are things which they put restrictions on, but as far as the capability, the solution being available, things like that, it's excellent, I would say, as a supplier of the SaaS solution, they've done a fantastic job.
It's interesting, the idea of the APIs being throttled, but I guess we shouldn't expect anything different. I guess, you know, Martin, that's pretty standard in any cloud. There's going to be throttling restrictions to stop you going and going, check, 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 check. I mean, it's a natural sort of part of that. But I guess that requires the vendors to think a bit about exactly how they are delivering that service, even if they have got API access.
Well, yeah, I think it's important, but APIs need to throttle. Otherwise, a piece of buggy code, you could implement a denial of service attack on the endpoint. It's nothing malicious, you don't think about it. So that ability to throttle back, not to cut it off, but just throttle back and put some warnings out there. You appear to be doing this. And yeah, and also there is the malicious thing, where somebody certainly starts to put 50,000 API calls towards the API at one time, and that's seen the whole thing's come to grinding halt. I think on both sides, both from the actual those people who are developing against the API, but also the API providers, they have to think about these things. I would like to think that application people who are writing SaaS would be thinking about this and thinking about how they throttle themselves, so they can see through their own telemetry that they can see, okay, hang on, we're now sending 50,000 API requests, something's gone wrong here. But I would also expect Microsoft, AWS, anybody to be fairly defensive about this as well and say, nope, cutting you off, or we're going to start restricting you now. We're going to making sure I hold back. And then it's down to the application developers to be able to deal with the fact that this is being throttled back for many reasons, just so they can cope. Your service doesn't fall over just because it's been throttled. It's got a sensible queuing mechanism. It knows what it's doing.
And that's, I guess, that sort of demonstrates that when you look at this, it's not a case of taking an existing backup product and saying, well, I'll just run it in the cloud and hide it from you and point the backup towards the APIs and off we go. You know, there's more engineering that has to go on behind the scenes to do this. You know, for instance, somehow you've got to provide, Sabaya, between the user's account and your account, a safe way to establish credentials. So when that user grants you permission to their mailbox, you know that you've done that in a very controlled, multi-tenant way. So there's a lot more to what you've done to develop this solution than just simply saying, we're running this, you know, our backup in the cloud and connecting it to a SaaS offer.
Excellent point, Chris. The way we thought about it was, we said the best thing here would be to integrate into Microsoft's identity management, and AD in this case, Microsoft AD. And because we integrated into that and are part of the service, things become a lot more streamlined. Again, the good thing about SaaS is that once you use the right set of services, life becomes a lot more cleaner. And that's what we have actually done. Not just cleaner for us, it's actually interaction with the customer and the new users coming up in their system, things like that. It's so much more cleaner. And the big thing for customers is that this also helps in terms of how do you manage permissions and things like that, right? There's one place you got to manage it on AD, and everybody else automatically inherits the right level of permissions. That's so much more useful, because life is so much more easier to manage rather than, oh, I did it here, I forgot to go do my backup software, and how do I do it? It's like, that becomes a problem for a lot of people. So, but this is integration AD has been a blessing, I would say.
Okay. And then in your environment, then, bear in mind, RTO and RPO would be established perhaps for on-premises technology. Maybe, you know, you'd set that in there and you'd have that as part of your dashboard and you'd see that and so on. Mm-hmm. How are customers expecting you to sort of match what they would know by RTO and RPO in a SaaS offering? Does it look any different, or is it literally, you know, being operated in exactly the same way?
It's an interesting, I'll split them into two parts, right? The recovery RPO, let's talk about the RPO here. In the RPO, in some sense, people start with saying, I want to back up every 5 minutes. We ask them, so why do you want to back up every 5 minutes, right? That's the first thing. Then you learn a little more, dig deeper into it. They said, I want to make sure all my email is safe, all my data is safe. Okay, that's your objective, not necessarily 5 minutes or 10 minutes is not the point, right? You want to make sure, as you guys said, all your email is journaled, all your captured. Okay, that's fine. If that's the case, here's what we can do. And obviously, there are some boundaries in which Microsoft sets, but that, as long as a big thing for us is to understand the customer real requirement rather than the specific RTO, RPO point there. So that's something we do. The second thing is with regards to the recovery time objective, how long it takes to recover. We run into a gamut. I'll probably tell you there are two kinds of things which actually happens. The good thing is in these services for very short-term recovery, there are good things, enough things built into the SaaS offering itself for short-term. Let's say in majority of the cases, accidentally some user deleted one email, things like that, within a day or so. There's a recycle bin, things like that you can get. And there are some things which are built in onto the one. So anything which is a little longer, when they want to get oh, I accidentally deleted a folder. I didn't realize I deleted it. As you said, your friend deleted it like the previous night, but that's probably one thing. Some people deleted like a week earlier. They don't realize it till they when they want something. Oh, shoot, I deleted something. That's where I kept all the data. I need it back. You run running in, and how long you get, right? The granularity of recovery, and that probably determines the speed. Searchability is one big thing we see in, especially in the communications world. Searchability is huge. We see that from customers. So a big part of recovery time objective is the searchability aspect of it. So once you really identify, then it's the laws of physics, right? How fast can you move your bits from A to B? But one is getting the data itself that's there. And that's what we see most often from customers. So far, at least from what we have seen from customers, is that because it's running a SaaS, they don't expect a DR offering or things like that. I know some people say, we want to offer a DR. We don't do that thing, just to be very clear. We have all the data. If you ever want to recover it on some other infrastructure, we can absolutely do it for you. But it's not a DR. But the big things we tell people is to think in terms of searchability, recoverability, and granularity of what you want to do. So that's something we talk about.
That raises a very interesting question. It sort of leads me on quite nicely to the next point I wanted to talk about, and that was the ways that SaaS might be different. We've already talked about the fact that you would probably charge a user per seat, per mailbox or something like that for backing up, for charging them for the use of the service. But I see things like unlimited storage capacity, and you just described there the fact that somebody might say, well, I need an email back from, you know, a week ago or a month ago or something like that. So I see there's a couple of things there. First of all, the fact that you're offering unlimited, and how do you justify that? How do you afford it? Secondly, that surely is now putting a huge amount of search onto your back-end infrastructure. If customers are coming in saying, I want to search every email I've ever sent for the last 15 years, or even that somebody might say, well, I want to do e-discovery across 10,000 email, you know, mailboxes to find this email set that where some guy was sending something out of the building that he shouldn't have been. That's going to put a massive amount of requirements on your back-end infrastructure, yet you're still charging a fixed cost.
It's a great point you mentioned. One of the things we always actually debate between is simplicity versus trying to extract the maximum in some sense, right? The big thing which we at Haiku believe is around simplicity, and that's what we decided to do here. We looked at the average of what customers actually have, what kind of, and how much should we truly charge? Because a lot of some of the organizations which have actually done it is on a per usage basis. I mean, how much capacity do you actually have on the source? Based on that, people charge. Some of the people have said, I will charge some for backup, some for compliance, some for this one, and then limit you the how much capacity you can maintain. The problem, one of the things as we were talking to customers, it became very clear. They said, guys, it's all good, but you're making my life so much complicated. The reason I went to SaaS is I want to simplify my life. I don't want to think in terms of elasticity. I don't want to think in terms of how fast can I grow? Oh my God, do I need to buy infrastructure? All that I want to get away from. Make it simple, make it clean so that I can actually go tell my service, this is when I use a service, this is the charge I pay. Can I do that? So that's why we took a little bit of a risky thing here. But I think the way we have built the infrastructure and the way we have our joint solution, the solution here, it is very, very, it's done efficiently. So that's why we are able to tell the customer, don't worry about how much capacity you actually have. Backup as much as you need. We'll keep it for unlimited amount of time because it's unlimited storage there. And you should be able to recover it. And that's, I think that's been an interesting challenge. And I think so far it's been done well.
Okay, so hold on a second. When you say unlimited amount of time, so let's just qualify this. So imagine I've got a mailbox. I've used it today. And you know, 5 years' time, I've continuously created and deleted records in that mailbox, and it might have a capacity of a certain amount. It might have, say, 25 gig or 50 gig capacity, but there's an awful lot more data gone through that I've created and deleted because there's churn of emails. You're saying that you will not charge me for the throughput of that. You'll just literally say it's unlimited, doesn't matter how much you've created and deleted over that time.
That is right. That is right, Chris, because when you, especially when in terms of a backup and when you're keeping the data for unlimited of time, every email, everything you have done over time is actually journaled and kept. So yes, it is. It's a significant amount of data. That is absolutely one of the things. So as long as the customer remains with Haiku in this case, we will keep the data for them for as however long they want to keep it. Absolutely, yes.
What's your thought on that, Martin? I mean, I can see that being like super expensive, super challenging.
Well, I'm going to move my media archive to them, and I'm just going to email it to myself, and he'll just keep deleting it. He's going, there you go, we'll have 50 petabytes. We'll have a single user. It's a funny idea. But do you have any ways of keeping an eye out for bad actors, people who really are abusing it? Because it does seem that everybody who's ever offered unlimited storage in some form or another has found themselves caught out by somebody who's going to abuse it, going to be clever, we said email, but you also can back up OneDrive. You could start dumping stuff into OneDrive, you back it up, you delete it, so it becomes like this infinite pool of storage which you just carry on using.
Yes. No, you bring up an excellent point, Martin and Chris, and you guys say that. There are things which we do constantly track in our usage, as you could imagine. There are, so far, knock on wood, I'll tell you, we have not found, because we are backing up our enterprise systems, and customers are cautious about it. Because of that, I think we have been safe, because in anything in your corporate data, you had to be a little careful of what you're putting there. So because of that, I think we have been safe on that thing. But that's a constant worry, always goes on. I mean, just to be very clear, good thing is, in public cloud, if you find the right way to keep your data stored in the right place and things like that, you can keep your costs low, but it does add up quite a bit if you don't monitor it properly. So absolutely. So for knock on wood, things have been good, but we have to keep track of it, as you guys say, always.
I used to watch people who, as an example, on mainframe days, when we used to record how much storage they had on disk, would issue a migrate of all of their data to tape. And then they'd get charged just for what was on disk. And then the next day they would start accessing it, and it would all get bit by bit retrieved back to disk again. So, of course, you start then thinking, well, actually, maybe the charging mechanism should be a bit more subtle and should be able to identify the fact that little things like that are happening. So I imagine a lot of services do evolve over time as they start to realize that customers are taking an advantage. And also, if you look at, say, provision of things like broadband or internet service to your house, you have typically an acceptable use policy, you know, where, yes, it might be unlimited in quotes, but in actual fact, if you're abusing that system, the chances are they'll be in touch with you and say, I'm afraid not, that's not what we call acceptable. So, yeah, I guess it's within the bounds of that, which makes sense.
I'd like to talk about unlimited and unlimited time as well. Do you have a mechanism? Because actually there are reasons why you don't want to keep data over a certain age. So there are reasons you do want those backups to go. Compliance, and the rules of compliance, if you've got it, you should produce it. And there are all kinds of things about how much data you can keep and how long it could. So as an enterprise, you want to be able to set those compliance rules and say anything older than 5 years, just delete and make sure it's never recoverable.
Spot on, Martin. You are absolutely right. I mean, that by default, the system, when it comes up, because we don't know what the user wants, we'll keep it by default forever. But you're spot on. One of the things a lot of customers end up doing is that they say, you know, we have 1 year backup policy, right? They have 1 year. That's it. One at the end of the year, they won't delete, because for good reasons, at least in the United States, as you guys know, for legal reasons, they'll say 1 year. After that, I want to take it off my thing. I don't want my books anymore. Take it off. So there are things which we allow the customer to, by default, it's on always. When you come in, you can always say, no. My policy is only 1 year. Do that. That said, there are times what happens is that you do for by default 1 year, 90 days. We have customers and a variety of them there. Some people come back and say, you know what, but the default is 1 year, but in case there's a lawsuit or something happens for certain mailboxes, I want to keep it for a legal hold. Don't delete anything. Don't make any change for a while till the law or whatever, till the case gets done. So we provide multiple options for customers. Default always on. You can always control it to however long your default policy is, and then set legal holds if needed. So, variety of options available.
I think it's a good point, Martin, because you know I've worked in places where we've actively deleted data, you know, actively deleted backups, because we've known that the rules sort of were set around the situation of saying, if you are asked to present some sort of data, you have to be able to legally present a case that says, I know it's deleted, so I can't present it to you, which is very different to being told, you need to show me that data, and then you saying, I can't show you the data because I can't recover it, even though I knew I was theoretically keeping it, in which case you could get fined because theoretically you did have it. Might have been on a tape that was damaged, or you might have not worked out where it was. But if you actively delete it and you can actively demonstrate that that data would not be being stored, that's a different legal case. And I think that's a really important distinction for a lot of companies.
It is, and also there is the granularity. So there'll be some users you need to keep. There's some types of email you might want to keep for much longer. In finance, and maybe things around mortgage and loans, which you'd keep for longer, and you won't keep everything else for longer. As you know, Chris, I mean, you've probably dealt with pharmaceuticals before. Pharmaceuticals, it's 100-year plus. For some of this data. So it does vary a lot. I mean, funny enough, I have been involved in court cases before where I've been an expert witness, where a company's been asked to produce data. Potentially they had the data, they had it on tapes, which were going to be very difficult to read. But our response was, well, we can produce ours if you can produce yours, because you knew that actually they had the same problem. And it was, we'll just forget about that now, shall we? But you do need some kind of legal destruction to make sure. Otherwise, the hiker could find themselves involved. So, well, you say you deleted it, but have you really? Can you recover it?
Yeah, and that's a very interesting angle, isn't it? Because at this point, are you a controller at this point of the data?
Yeah.
According to GDPR terms, I suppose you would be, wouldn't you?
I guess the processor, right?
Processor. So you've still got legal responsibilities where you have to, you know, act within a certain way. So again, all parts of delivering a SaaS offering, very different to delivering something that's a product. So Sabaya, just as we wrap this bit up about what you've done in the current release, one thing I think that clearly has come up time and time again as a requirement in one form or another is your ability to do e-discovery for people. We just mentioned it there in terms of the volume of data that potentially you might be holding, and therefore that makes it quite challenging for you. But clearly, e-discovery is really important to many businesses. And you know how you do that and how, for example, that integrates with all the other offerings you already have in place today. So what are you doing for e-discovery?
One thing we realized as we were talking to a lot of these customers, traditionally, when people first thing they think of O365 is the backup and recovery. That's the first thing to think of because it's a service. I got to protect the data. But then if you look at when do you most often leverage the data, apart from your regular transactional recovery requests and things like that for people, the majority of the time in the organization, this becomes critical is that for two reasons. One is for compliance, and the other one is for legal in cases and things like that, right? And as you said, Martin, in some of the pharmaceutical, they got to keep the data forever. I mean, it's a long time they got to keep. And same thing, not just pharmaceutical, same thing in financial, as you guys know about the financial institutions. Every information has to be tracked. I mean, I'll tell you a funny story. A customer told me, I got to recover all the chats. I said, why would you want to recover a chat? Initially, I keep my mind open. He said, guys, that's part of the transaction. In every communication, we have to be able to recover. And he said, you know, you would be surprised how many chat recoveries I do in my weekly things because it is part of our compliance thing. And we got to demonstrate not every transaction the customer or the user did. I got to be able to show you. So that's part of it. So that's something which we do that. Going back to e-discovery itself, I'll tell you. So as I said, one is the backup record. The other part is the e-discovery part. The e-discovery itself is that one thing customers want to do is, as first, they said searchability. The first thing as part of e-discovery is discovery aspect, right? So being able to recover that, find the right data. Across all their infrastructure, not just the emails, the OneDrive, the SharePoint, right? Because now the data is spread all over the place. So being able to search for that. The second thing is, in a classic e-discovery, the big thing is first tagging it, right? Because you have to know, oh, this thing looks like communication between two people. This thing looks like, or the person copied all these data, this thing XYZ, right? So you capture tagging all that information. Then the third thing is that not just tagging, how do they share it with the lawyers? As you know, a big part in the e-discovery process is tagging it and sharing it to your auditors because they have to come and audit what's actually happened, being able to do that. And the last thing I'll tell you in this entire e-discovery process is who had access to data when and what did they do with it, the entire journey of that particular cycle. Being able to do all that for a customer, that's been an important thing. And we said it's better to actually release the whole thing and make it part of the base capability for the customer so that way they can actually do the e-discovery too in the system. So that's one of the things we are very happy we have in the base product because that seems to be extremely valuable for customers.
Okay. I'm interested to see how that might evolve. I don't know what you think, Martin, but to me, when you're in an environment like AWS or if you're, you know, whichever cloud provider you're in, there are some pretty mature tools in the back end to do AI, to do analytics, to do analysis across that data. And it might be, some of it might be e-discovery, some of it might be something more advanced. It will be really interesting to see what APIs are exposed by vendors like Haiku to allow them to go and the customer to trawl their own data and start doing, you know, clever search with it.
Yeah, so analytics of those emails, chats, good for understanding customer interactions. So a lot which can be done. It has to be handled in a very careful and sensitive manner. Your employees may not be very happy if they think that you're regularly running ML against their emails to see what they're up to. But it absolutely invaluable for understanding how conversations work within an organization, even at a meta level, so you can work out who's talking to who, who's collaborating. Not for any nefarious reasons, just to understand how communication works in your organization, but also customer interactions. You can analyze. Are there best practice? Are people dealing with queries very quickly? Are they turning into long conversations? What's going on? What is the email which is coming in to say help? And what's the best responses which you see? So yeah, I can see eventually it's beyond e-discovery, or you know, it still is e-discovery, but it's e-discovery for different uses.
Yeah, I agree, and I'd really be interested. I mean, I think we're sort of touching now on futures really here, and I think that level of e-discovery and the ability to trawl down into your data and really start using that as a secondary set of data you can do some really interesting analysis on. I think, Sabaya, that's where customers probably are hoping that these sort of solutions are going to head towards.
I can actually give you guys a little insight. One of the things, we have a solution, think part in our solution called Insights. To the, some of the examples, Martin, you said, like, given a user, who all are they communicating with, right? Because this actually comes in very handy even at the time of e-discovery, things like that, as you guys can imagine. Between November to December, who did this person communicate with before they were leaving or before they did something bad? So you want to be able to track. Again, not trying to snoop into things, but this is, as you said, Martin, at the end of the day, the organization wants to know. It doesn't have to be at the data level, but it's a question of saying, which domains are we communicating with? Which people are we communicating in the organization? That's something there. So that is actually built into the base solution at the top level of who's communicating to what. That's something we actually track in the system and give it call insights. We do that. And the second thing for customers, sometimes they ask us is that, what's the average response rate in the organization? Things like that. How often are the emails being read? How often is there? What's the typical response in the organization, right? Because the HR team sometimes wants to know the collaboration, things, what's happening, things like that. So that's something also built in. But there's so much, once you have the data, there's so much analytics. But as Martin, you said, a big thing is the GDPR compliance and some of the compliance data thing, because there is, you're dealing with people's data, so you have to be really, really careful. And that's one of the things we are so careful about, what is shown to whom, because it's an extremely sensitive thing we are dealing with. So, absolutely.
So I think that would be interesting to see as a future, to see where that's going to head. I think that's one area, I think, that justifies the idea of using backup as a service, is just the ability to genuinely do something more with the data. And I think because you're in the cloud and you've got access to other services that are spun up on demand, and you know, you're paying for the computer when you need it and various other bits of equipment, I think being in the cloud is really helpful at that point. How are you going to bring customers who are running on-premises backup, cloud-based backup, into that model so that this all ends up being unified? So whether they're backing up data that was in their own data center, in a SaaS offering, in the cloud, they can run similar tools and services against that data in the future.
It's a great question you're asking, Chris. I mean, I think I'll tell you, we're taking one step at a time. I'll just be candid with it. I mean, like, I think ideally we would like to do, customers want to do, like, for example, searches across multiple data sets across both on-prem and the public cloud and so on. It is there. That's an evolution where we need to get to. One thing we observe right now is that when we look at customers and where they want to go, that's what they're talking about. But practically, when it comes to searchability, recovery of data, things like that, today what happens is still they look at it on a per domain basis. They want the expertise in each one of the areas because it's very specific metadata, things like that they're looking for. That's what they're doing. But as customers evolve, you will absolutely look into some of the points you mentioned, because, for example, in the public cloud in Google, for example, one of our customers said, hey, I want to analyze for any data in their databases. They wanted to do certain kinds of PCI compliance checks, and that's something they want to. I said, we could do it ourselves, but we said, why reinvent the wheel when Google already has the best PCI checking technologies available? So we take our data, apply there, let the customer run the Google service on top of it and get it. So absolutely, we will roll further.
Absolutely. And surely, Martin, I mean, this is the perfect use for secondary data. I mean, I've been very negative about on-premises backup appliances that claim to be able to do all of this deep analytics and all the rest of it. But it seems like if that data is in the cloud in the right format, these are the sort of applications we've been waiting for to be able to do this sort of stuff.
It's a limited use case. It's a sensible use case. I mean, we've heard the promise of secondary data so much, and we've both been pretty cynical about it. But something like this seems to make perfect sense.
Mm. Yeah, good. Okay. So, Sabai, you know, looking at this, are you going to give us any clue about what we might see coming up in the future in terms of backup as a service?
It's an interesting question, Chris. I mean, there's so much going on all the time, and it's an exciting time. I mean, the thing which I can tell you is that you can see tremendous more capabilities coming from Haiku very shortly. As you know, we started with just the on-prem infrastructure with Nutanix alone, and then VMware, and then Google, and now Azure, and now O365. It's a natural evolution from on-prem infrastructure to public clouds to SaaS offerings. And as you could imagine, SaaS offerings, what you have touched, O365, one of the largest SaaS solutions customers are using. But there's a lot more SaaS. There's a lot more public cloud infrastructure, which we have to protect data for customers. There's a lot more data around what customers are running their business critical infrastructure. You could see very shortly in the next, we'll probably come on again in this first half of this year, there'll be a lot more activity. You'll see that too.
Okay. Okay. Fair enough. I'll let you off the hook. And as long as you promise to come back. Okay. So what about now then? So what about going off and trying this out? What's the availability? Can customers try this today? You know, Absolutely. How do they sign up? What do they do?
Perfect. All they have to go is tryhaiku.com and say, I want to sign up. And we will send them an opportunity to actually send them the infrastructure. We will actually provision them a service so that they can actually play with their live infrastructure in their own O365 account rather than trying from us. Or if it's easier, we can actually show them a quick rundown for the customer, a live demo. And that's something they can test it out anytime. It's just tryhaiku.com. That's simple.
Sounds great. We'll put that in the show notes and get people to give it a go. But for now, Sabai, thanks very much. Great conversation, and catch up with you soon.
Thank you very much, Chris and Martin. As always, pleasure talking with you guys.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.